And welcome to Power Reflections, a proud member of the Doof Network, where we reflect on Wobbo's most fetching work as it releases. I'm Ruben Morehouse.
And I'm Elliot Diebold.
And we're coming at you live from the Discord. Pew, pew, pew. Hi, Discord. And today is a very special episode, Elliot. Do you want to tell everyone why that is?
It's the 101st episode?
Exactly right, which is the same number of episodes that is Dalmatians in the movie, so that's obviously a pretty good
hugely important milestone.
But it's worth noting that as we, you know, this is our first post Thanksgiving episode, but also we're about to head into the holidays, and the holiday schedule is going to be a bit screwy, especially because you're also moving house during the next 2 weeks, so it's going to mess with our scheduling. Actually, not our scheduling, just our format a bit. So the next two episodes are going to be just me hanging out with y'all. Then we'll have a normal episode, and then the two episodes after that will be just Elliot, and then we'll be back to normal. So we're going to have a month of different episodes. I don't know exactly what Elliot's going to do in his episodes, but my episodes are going to be a little bit shorter, and I'll get into some of the stuff at the end when we talk about it. But giving everyone a heads up.
I haven't thought about what I'll do in mine too much. I'll probably just steal any good ideas you have because you're going first. But I'm really excited because I think I didn't enjoy how alone things were when we did this last year. But now that we've already sort of started doing things live on the Discord, I think it'll be really fun to still record them live. And even though you're like, you know, the other person isn't here, you sort of got the people in Discord to work off of live.
Yeah, exactly right. So yeah, there'll still be live recordings and all that stuff. But we'll just have lost Elliot for 2 weeks for the next two episodes. Anyway, let's get into the actual episode, shall we?
Let's do it.
We're looking at playing apart 15.7 and 15.8 this week, starting with 15.7, we're with Avery. And these two chapters are like chronologically taking place immediately right after the previous chapter. So Avery and Verona have just been told that Thea's up to some no good shit. Mm-hmm. And they're given a ride over to near where Thea is by Sootsleeves, and Verona kind of on the way here is interrogating Sootsleeves a bit and getting to know her past and her path a bit more.
I just, right from the fucking get-go, though, I was just like, oh, fuck, I love Sootsleeves. She's driving around one-handed while trying to, like, unlock this puzzle that is a can of soda. All the stuff with the soda is great, particularly because it's apple-flavored. That ties into the boon that she was able to give people. I just love it.
Yeah, it's great stuff. Sootsleeves maintains a position as top tier character.
Because she's like, she's kind of good at getting the world. Like, she has that whole thing about how the world is kind of always the same. But it's those little quirks that just completely catch her off guard, like the concept of fizzy drink. I could almost just see her, rather than giving out bushels of apples, if she reinstated her path, she'd just buy a bunch of this soda and give that out because she doesn't want it anymore. And cherry pops also here, which is just always a delight, especially when she's paired with Snow.
Yeah, I mean, cherry pop continues to be delightful, of course. The pop and drop dynamic is great. Putting aside the actual specifics of Sootsleeves' path for a second, I think it's really interesting the fact that she is a lost who has, you know, like, lost, I guess, her path. Like, Sootsleeves as an other who has a kingdom, I think, makes sense for her to have a path or to very naturally fit into a path. I wonder if there's like a correlation between the strength of a lost and their path they have, or like, is if Miss, right, as a lost, had stayed in the paths, would she eventually get her own path, and what would that look like? Or would it be more like, I don't know, how does the mechanics of lost getting paths work? I find that very interesting.
So my understanding of it is also to address Miss specifically, I think she was like actively avoiding having that happen to her. Part of her whole like no roles, no labels sort of thing.
Yes.
From memory, the paths, it's just like random crap floating around in, you know, the sort of space essentially. And random bits kind of clump together and form the paths. So I guess it just kind of depends, like, where the other sits into that. Like, Sootsleeves, you know, just sort of either got, like, randomly assembled or dragged in as a kind of royalty thing. and that fit into the path, so she was given that role, I guess.
But surely there's some kind of feedback, even if, you know, the path is somewhat built originally. It seems like from Sutsu's description that it's pretty iconically her path, right? I wonder how much, not agency, but influence, I guess, consciously or subconsciously, others would have on the paths and that stuff. I just find, yeah, I don't know.
Oh, yeah. Like, once it had formed, I have no doubt that, yeah, as its kind of wolf, essentially, that she had some say in kind of trying to steer things.
Not all paths have a wolf, right? Like, you know, Zoomtown, as an example, doesn't. The station promenade had a wolf, but it wasn't really the wolf of that path.
Yeah, exactly. Like, I think the thing with, like, paths in general is if you're going to try and ascribe any pattern to them, you're probably just doing it wrong because they are just random clumps of crap. I think the closest you probably get to something consistent is this idea of they're that linear sort of journey that can be taken. And I think that's just because, like, the core of this world is telling a story, and that's, like, a fundamental aspect of a story. Like, for a path to form, it needs to form some sort of linear story. Although, I mean, I'm saying linear, I'm sure eventually there'll be some path that breaks that rule somehow. Like an open world path or some shit. But, I love, like, learning about, like, how Soot Sleeves, yeah, like, got this path, and she's just so fucking, she like refuses to admit how shit it was.
Which again, like, she's iconically Soot Sleeves.
Yeah, like she knows that her kingdom is kind of like the suffering sort of kingdom, and she's like, she's very self-aware in some ways, but she's so proud of it at the same time that she can kind of, she can't let herself believe that they were a trap path that was just shit, which is what it sounds like it was.
Yeah. Yeah, it's not a great path. But yeah, I know, like, again, Soot Sleeves feels very, yeah, like, she's got that proudness, but she also feels very compassionate towards her people, and just, like, all this stuff about how great Soot Sleeves is as a leader. I just love it.
Yeah. Yeah, she, you know, she had these failed campaigns or whatever, and she's clearly, like, a bit of an idiot, but she fucking cares about her people. Like, in a really, really upfront way. Like, you can't help but like her as a leader because of that.
Yeah.
Like, it sort of, it almost makes me wonder, you know, they talked about how she waged a campaign across the dream and all that, and, like, you know, failed miserably or whatever. And I wonder if that ties into your idea, like, if they were intentionally doing a campaign or something, like, she was trying to change what her kingdom was.
Yeah,
like, if they took over others, maybe they wouldn't be the starving, suffering, sick kingdom anymore, but they could be a bit more of a, like, conquering kingdom.
Yeah, I could see that. I wonder if it was her attempt to change the, you know, the fate that was dealt out to her subjects.
Because she doesn't seem like the warmongering kind or anything, so, like, I was trying to, like, reconcile, why would Soot Sleeves launch some sort of campaign like that? And the only thing I can think of is if she was trying to change the story for her and her subjects.
Yeah. Which just makes her even more endearing, this headcanon.
Yeah. It's a pretty good reason to start a war. Like, on the list of reasons to start wars, it's pretty high up there. Yeah. But yeah, we should talk about, like, something you mentioned is how Verona is really the one sort of interrogating and pushing Soot Sleeves, and, like, Avery's role in most of this conversation is usually just to be like, hey, can we chill? And that just really jumped out to me because usually, like, Verona is the other whisperer and Avery is kind of the one who, you know, just stands there and says cool beans. But in this particular conversation, Avery's really the one who kind of gets Soot Sleeves, and Verona's just kind of sitting in the back being a little bit of a, like, ignorant dickhead. And part of that's because she's tired, but I also... I think this is, like, the first sign of something we're going to talk about a lot this week, which is Verona is going through some changes in her personality or you know, hiding her personality and trying to psych herself up to kill Charles. And this is just a bit where she's like, she just wants to, like, get the facts, and she's not really thinking about feelings, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, I think Verona has kind of been like that. There's been elements of that already. I think it feels to me like she doesn't have the energy to put on the mask as much, you know, like,
yeah, 100%.
To play nice, I guess. She just doesn't have the energy for it at the moment. So she's just defaulting to that undercurrent of, she wants to know answers and she doesn't really care if she offends people to get her point across. She's not considering that much.
Yeah, which is absolutely something. I think, like, I'm probably not alone in relating to that after the last 2 years. I think the last 2 years is, like, a lot of people, like, so much of normal socializing in society kind of fell away, and as we're all coming back into it, there are certain parts where you're just like, man, I don't have the energy to pretend to be interested in that anymore.
I'm with you on that for sure. It's very relatable, especially contemporarily.
Yeah. And I guess, like, because the next stage of this is after, like, they part ways with Soot Sleeves, Verona is kind of like, I think binding might have been the right call there.
Mm.
Which is definitely, like, an interesting and very loaded argument in this story.
Yeah.
Avery brings up the super valid point of, well, yeah, there's another way, which is bring them down to Earth. And we don't quite understand how Soot Sleeves then got bound after being brought, like, down to Earth. Which is, you know, a really interesting story, and there's some theories, but, like, this was just, again, like, it feels like Verona is saying things like this, saying, like, oh, maybe binding was right. I just couldn't help but see it as her helping prepare Avery for the idea that they're going to have to kill Charles.
Yeah, interesting. Raising that idea that they've always been so against to try and start seeding it. Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't think it's intentional, but...
I'm 50-50 on whether that's sort of, like Verona's general thing, if she's wanting to push that line consciously to sort of get Lucy and Avery ready, or whether it's just indicative of these changes she's going through with all her time in the Undercity. And we'll talk about that a lot more next chapter. But, like, I kind of feel like it's maybe a little bit of both.
Interesting.
Like, this Alexander-y side of Verona definitely feels like it's coming to the fore at the moment.
Yeah. Interesting. So yeah, Avery and Verona find their way to Thea's hideout, and they kind of scope it out a bit. They see that there's some interesting wards there and disguise up as they prepare to head inside. And, you know, Verona gets a chance to flex some diagram interpretation skills and does very well. And we'll see Verona just kind of continuing to hit the beats of being really good at the practice over these two chapters.
Yeah, and this is also our first sign that Thea is really good at these wardings, which is another thing we'll come back to. So it's all just like, this is just a little moment that's almost prepping us as readers for, like, here's the shit that's going to be happening soon. And you don't even realize it the first time you're going through, but it's great.
Yeah. I love this moment where Verona starts kind of doing her whole, like, oh, I've got a plan, I'm going to do my thing without telling anyone what's going on mode. But Avery calls out that she's tired, and she said she was tired and she should be collaborating. Verona just is like, oh yeah, cool. And, like, it's a very simple moment when Verona lets Avery in on what she's planning, and Avery, you know, talks about it, and they come to the realization that some parts of it are good, some parts of it might not work and it needs to change. Like, they're really collaborating and communicating and on the same page. And that is so true throughout these whole chapters. And it's just very fun.
Yeah, well, because really these, nice.
Yeah,
well, because these are the two who have very much been like, the concepts of teamwork and collaboration have been super important to their, like, character arcs for, you know, a while now. And so that was like, when I sort of realized we had these two back to back this week, it was just like, oh, this is the perfect opportunity, because, like, this is what this whole trip is kind of about, really, is. Teamwork is so important to these two at the moment, but for, like, completely opposite reasons almost. And that difference is really obvious seeing them side by side this week. Like, we start here with Avery, and she's constantly doing, as you said, she's, like, reaching out, making sure they're in sync. She's so proud of the moments they are, like the bit where Verona hands her the key behind her back later, and then, like, has the suit of her glamour ready for her to step into. Like, there's these moments where Verona picks up the slack, and for Avery, that is just, like, crack. Like, that it's just, this is what she wants, is teamwork like that. And then, like, you know, next chapter, we're going to go into Verona's head, and she's just, like, constantly worried she's stuffed up. Whenever Avery carries things, she's like, oh, I've let her down.
Yeah.
Like, she's just, I get, like, this is all stuff we've been talking about for arcs, and none of it's new, but just, like, really seeing it side by side here.
Verona stuff, isn't it?
Yeah, this trip is just such a great opportunity to really examine those differences side by side, and make you think, oh, like, Verona really needs to figure this shit out.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, this has been true for a while, so I guess we don't need to dive into too much, but I fully
exactly.
Yeah. So I want to talk about this. Like, I know Thea hasn't met Avery before, but even still, their subterfuge here feels like it's not especially going to hold up to much scrutiny, right? Like, I mean, I was thinking about that, and obviously the complicating factor about that is it does work. We hear
Thea's... Yeah, it goes well.
Yeah, and like Thea doesn't seem to know that it's them. She suspects witch hunters. And I don't know. It was interesting to me. Like, it made me think that I guess it's a reflection of how knowledgeable the Kenneteers are because of their, you know, patrons slash the fact that they went to the BHI for a while and you know, they have connections with people like Zed and Ray and whatever. I wonder, like, potentially Thea didn't go, almost certainly didn't go to the BHI. We don't really know that, but that seems probable. So maybe she's never met anyone who really uses glamour, and it's actually... We just have a higher expectation of what practitioners understand from being at the BHI. But
didn't they specifically call out glamour though? Because it was like a brownie-ish thing that originally trapped her. So like,
true.
Yeah. I mean, I agree with you. I had the same thought. Like at this stage in the operation, I was like, how the fuck do they think this is going to work?
Exactly. Is...
The lack of planning is just, I guess sometimes protagonists can work without serious planning, but like it just makes you worried. I was thinking back to like Lucy last week specifically with like, remember we called out sort of Lucy being like, oh, don't let them know it's Kennet. Just go out there with a bunch of tricks from various different types of others because that's not your signature.
Exactly. Right. And this feels like as well.
This is like, I was like, this isn't quite as bad, but it was certainly like they just really kind of went in undercover and there was no plan to, I think like Verona briefly talks about misdirecting her at the wits or something. And Avery says, no, we can't do that. Mm. So they just kind of go in and it's just like, what? There's no plan for if you get even remotely caught. Yeah.
And like, so obviously they we're jumping around a little bit, but you know, that Avery hides her ritual that she's doing from, you know, in a position where it won't be found by or won't be seen by Thea to try and, you know, not give Thea that clue on who she was. But also, like, they have an item that is something to do with Realm's escape, right? They have, you know, seemingly glamour. I don't know if Thea cracks on to the fact that they have used glamour or not, but Faye and Finder are two of the key things that Thea might know that they have, and putting that together, like, I don't think there's that many people who fit that description, right? Lucy is a Fae duelist, even though obviously Lucy's not here, but that's an association. And Avery is a finder, and like, I don't know. Yeah, I don't know. Maybe I'm being too hard on them, but it felt like Thea could figure it out pretty, like, as soon as Thea talks to, like, mentions it to Florin potentially, like, that's it, right?
Yeah, obviously it works, but I think my impression is they kind of got lucky and there's 100 ways it could have not.
Yes.
So, yeah, I don't know. I do think it's just, kind of interesting. Like, it ties into, I think, what we talked about with Avery and, like, she using, like, a Lost and using Soot Sleeves as your spy is very much, like, pointing it back at you. And I will give them credit. There's nothing here that explicitly, like, Glamour doesn't sort of uniquely point back to them or anything.
Yes,
so,
of course. You know,
but it's inherently fragile.
Yeah, I don't know. Maybe we're being too harsh on them. It just felt to me like it would be pretty fine to figure it out as soon as you had one or two key clues. Anyway.
Yeah.
Anyway, Avery and Verona head inside and they find themselves not in a store, but this store has transformed into a high-towered village where kids are flying around and all around us having a great time, and it seems great.
Yeah, I mean, like, this genuinely seems like a great day trip. Mm. It's like, you know, those indoor skydiving things that's like on my bucket list. I really want to try one of those one day.
100%. It's like going to like a wind tunnel kind of vibe.
Yeah. Like a cooler version of that.
Yeah, I love how when they walk into it, Verona goes, "What in the world is this actual magic?" And everything's acting. And I just thought that was very fun.
Yeah, I love how quickly Verona can just turn that shit on, and then Avery is just always that one who's like, oh, yeah, good thought. Like, with all that emphasis on teamwork we sort of talked about this week, there's definitely this vibe of, Verona runs off and does things, Avery, and then makes Avery follow, versus when Avery does things, she's usually a lot better at trying to communicate to Verona what she's doing.
Yes, of course. So Verona goes flying while Avery kind of tries to figure out what the trick of this place is and what the specific rules might be, without letting Thea on to the fact that she knows more than she should.
Yeah, and like Avery really deserves props here for like being able to hold this conversation and kind of pass herself off as somebody just like a dumb kid asking stupid questions, while subtly she does a really good job of like taking notes of the subtle details Thea lets slip in her phrasing. Like one thing Thea briefly says is like the ornithologist made this realm, and Avery quickly latches onto that as important. I was just really impressed with Avery's ability to actually act like an idiot here, but sneakily be getting a lot of info.
Yeah, she definitely does well at it. I think during this part, it's really interesting that Avery is kind of really seems to want to find a reason for Thea to be innocent, right? Like,
yeah,
Thea, this is clearly very dodgy, and Avery knows that, but is like, yeah, I guess it comes back to what we were talking about with Verona kind of seeding the idea of doing bad things so they can eventually kill Charles, where Avery is like, she really, really needs a smoking gun before she's willing to act against somebody. Like, she really is so unwilling to go after somebody, even if there's a tiny chance they're innocent. I think, you know, it's, I suppose, a good quality.
Doesn't Verona, at the end of next chapter, sort of say that thing where she's like, I hope you don't have to unlearn this faith in people, but I think you're going to? How to deal with people. And I feel like this is, like, that's sort of what you're speaking to here, this idea that Avery want, but like Thea is sort of justifying a lot of what she's doing as like, oh, I'm just, you know, giving these kids a good time and like blah blah, and it, like, kind of tries to sell it. And there's this part of like, I had it as well as Avery, of like, I wanted to believe that all she's up to is just like trying to give kids what she had but without the bad part.
Yeah, and that would be nice, but you know. Right, it's
yeah,
doesn't, well, seem likely.
I mean, like that said, there's this really interesting moment where Thea snaps at one of the kids who's like, you know, we were best friends, but we won't be best friends anymore. And like Thea just fucking, like, this triggers something in her heart. And she's like, no, best friend shit is like, and like, that's sort of that first moment where you're like, oh, okay, like, for whatever crazy shit Thea is doing, like, she's still carrying a lot of guilt over what happened with her best friend.
Later, there's another moment later as well where she is kind of confessing to Avery about, like, hey, I was in a world like this and I made some mistakes. And maybe this is a manipulation, but it doesn't feel like a manipulation at the time.
No, I don't think it is. Like, I think Thea's general, as much as she's kind of stuck in the past, and we'll probably talk about that as we see her vault, I think there's almost this side to her that, like, thinks that what she's giving these kids here is good. And so, you know, it's like, oh, you know, she'll, you know, take them apart for, you know, spare parts, or whatever. But, like, in the meantime, she's giving them this little bit of magic before she does so, and, like, helping them find magic and find friendship before she kills them. And that's, like, good. And it's like, yeah, there's still this part of her that wants kids to have the good part of what she had before she, you know, takes them apart.
Yeah. She's an interesting character, isn't she? I think we'll get more into this maybe in the next chapter as well. Just like, yeah. We'll get into this a bit more later.
Yeah.
Avery kind of steps through all the things that she thinks this place could be. And I think it's a fun little bit of lore of, like, Avery explaining to us all the different types of magical items, which is great.
It's a sort of stuff. It's a sort of segment where I was like, okay, if I'm ever running a Pack Dice campaign, bookmark 15.7 for, like, helping me build magical items. Like, just sort of really fun to learn the system Wildbow's kind of using to categorize some of these items along one axis, at least.
Yeah, it's good stuff. So Avery needs evidence to figure out what Thea's up to. So she sets up one of the kids there, Kai, to see how Thea will respond to this. And in the interim, Thea's kind of questioning Avery a little bit more actively.
Yeah, and this is where those moments from Avery's side where we see the teamwork really sort of peak, like Verona's just able to pass her that key. Like Avery's just riding a high right now from how well it's all going, and it's just the pride before the fall, basically.
Yeah, yeah. It almost goes really well, but we'll get to that. But there's a through bit here of Avery asking Thea why she looks like a kid in the painting, and Thea dodges the question every time. And that really jumped out to me, especially on my second read of like, I mean, I don't think Thea's actually a kid, but what's the importance of drawing this out? And potentially it's something that will help us defeat Thea later on if there's something about her identity that marks her as a child. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, the obvious answer feels like it's a symbol of how she hasn't moved on from what happened to her in there.
Yes.
Like she still sees herself as... yeah, the girl she was when Otis saved her, basically. Like, yeah, she hasn't really moved on.
Yeah.
And I mean, the fact that she's seemingly trying to recreate a very similar realm for herself.
I guess I'm jumping ahead in the notes again here, but like, it's pretty common in this story, the idea of people being stuck in the past versus the new ways of doing things and thinking, setting up the dynamic of, you know, being progressive as our protagonists versus being regressive or stuck in the past as our enemies. And that's kind of something that applies to practitioners as a whole. And Thea's a great marker for that as someone who is so clearly stuck in the past.
Oh, Thea feels like a textbook sort of case of somebody who was abused growing up into the same kind of abuser. Like she's taking kids and snipping off parts of their souls. Like, how is that not sort of the same shit that was kind of done to her? And I'm so interested because, we're sort of assuming she's recreating a similar-ish world to where she was stuck. But, like, why? Like, does she just want to go and live in there? Like, that feels like the obvious answer, but, like, is there more to it? Like, is there... I'd be so interested to get Thea's monologue on why she's doing what she's doing because it feels like there's probably just some extra twist to it that I can't quite figure out.
Well, we don't know what... I think what I will find interesting is, like, it's not that Thea is just looking for a magical world to live in, right? Because she's found a number of them, as we'll get to in the next chapters. She's specifically trying to go back to this place where she was, right? And clearly there's something of importance there. And it might just be this, like, being stuck in the past and wanting to kind of recapture her glory youth, but potentially there's like relationships or something about this world that she's built up that will kind of make it land even more. I don't know. I guess we'll have to see.
But maybe you know what it could be, because her best friend ran off, right? Did we ever find out what happened to her best friend who ran? Like, maybe she's just trying to recreate this place so she can get her best friend back. That seems sad and pathetic enough that I'm willing to buy it.
Yes, and unlikely to ever eventuate, huh?
Oh, yeah, but I mean, I don't think this is a plan born of, you know, logic or anything.
Yeah, yeah. So, Kai plays along with Avery's plan and does really well, and Thea starts to turn the screws.
Yeah, this really sort of kicks the Thea hornet's nest as intended when the key comes out. It works a charm. I mean, you know, it plays into, as we talked about already, it plays into all the stuff like about best friend betrayals and pitting friends against each other. And you can see that just really upsets Thea.
Yeah. Kai does very well. He doesn't sell them out. Well done, Kai. Kai for the next Kenneteer. Let's start the campaign early.
I mean, yeah, add him to the queue, I guess. So he'll be like the 20th Kenneteer.
We've got a lot of... you know, potential fourth Kenneteer recruits. When are the Kenneteers going to start opening up a membership, huh? They need they need the people. It's clear.
I want to see the auditions. They've got to hold auditions.
Yeah, come on. Do some tryouts, huh? I guess they kind of have been doing tryouts. I mean, like, Lucy is basically trying out Melissa right now, right?
Yeah, and Bracken even. Although that's more for the Council.
Yeah. Anyway, Kai doesn't give them up, but Thea's still onto them, and she throws the painting at them, which puts them into this world, and then starts harvesting the kids.
I mean, this is such a great ending to the sort of chapter. Like, this is one of those really hype
yeah,
cliffhangers where you're like, oh, next chapter's going to be fucking wild.
Yeah. So yeah, that's fun. Athea reveals that yes, she was always a villain, but she tries to justify it by saying she wasn't going to keep or imprison them, just have him snip off the wings and hamstrings of their souls, which...
Yeah, you know, just, what's your problem, Ruben?
Yeah, no, I mean, it sounds like a good plan. I mean, if this is what you can get the ornithologist to do, hey, why not? It seems clearly great. Yeah, carve up their souls. Go for it, Thea. Yeah. The moral, you know, contradiction that Thea has of, like, seemingly both being very much about kind of the joy of her childhood while also being willing to abuse and murder children. I don't know, like, she's a very fun, compelling character to detest.
Yeah, like, exactly. Like, how does she reconcile in her head the fact that she's giving these kids that magic, but then also, like, presumably the hammies and wings of the soul are, like, the parts that let you, like, move. Like, move, you know,
around,
to,
yeah.
Yeah, like, especially the wings to, like, soar. Like, you know, I assume the wings would be tied into the ideas of, like, imagination and dream sort of stuff, like freedom of the soul. So, like, taking that away is presumably, like, dooming these kids to become stalled and, like, stuck, which, like, Thea, how do you not see, like, that's, like, she's just spreading exactly what happened to her, and how does she reconcile that?
Yeah. I mean, I don't think she thinks about it, right? I think she, that's the problem.
Yeah, yeah, and this is the great thing about her, is she's clearly, like, she wants to get back and, like, fix herself or whatever, and just doesn't realize that she's just causing it to become a more widespread pattern.
Yeah, she's literally just perpetuating the cycle. But
she's doing it more and worse.
As a good thing, so.
Does she? She's dedicated her whole life to building the board game to go back, so yeah, maybe.
Yeah, right, like...
Yeah, no, I think there's this, like, inherent, like, disconnect in her brain between, like, trying to get herself back and, like, not realize, or, you know, trying to justify what she's doing to other people by giving them those good moments in the middle.
Yes, definitely. Yeah. But yeah, so that's where we leave this chapter. We go straight into Verona's chapter, with Verona preparing to tackle the ornithologist to buy time for Avery to, you know, get them away out of here.
Yeah, and I want to say, I think it's been a while since we had one of these, like, just chapters that, you know, was largely just like an action heavy chapter of, like, an encounter that isn't plugged into, I guess, the main plot. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah,
it's not like a fight that is part of the fight against, like, Marissica in arc 13 or whatever. Like, this is just sort of a fight that, you know, is going to be over in a chapter or two tops.
Yeah, like, I guess it's been Verona carrying that with, like, her journeys into the underside.
Yeah, but even then, you, like, you know that, you know, she's just going to go back there or something. Like, this is very much one of those fights that's just, you know, it's going to, like, the ornithologist is going to be gone in a couple of chapters. And, like, yeah, you know, so this is sort of a one-off fight. We don't really know anything about him. There's no existing history here, no stakes that tie into the rest of Kennet. This is just a fight that's going to go fucking wild and be action-packed. And then at the end of it, we're just going to be like, fuck, that was cool.
Yep.
And it's been a while since we had something like that. And I was like, oh, I've missed this.
Yeah. And I do love the vibes of this, because this is the realm of the ornithologist, and fighting somebody in their realm, like the kind of breaking the rules that he does throughout this whole chapter is just so fun. And the immediate description of him is so, like, because he kind of just looks like a guy, but with a bunch of weird shit, like, his size changes. He sometimes looks taller, sometimes smaller. And the line that I really liked is, as if drawn by different artists with the same instructions and reference material, but no guidelines on scale. And when I say he's a guy, obviously he's giant. Like, he's not just a dude, but, like, I don't know. I really just love how Wabo is able to take what is effectively a biologist, right? Like, some random biologist, and turn him into a monster. Like, I just think it's awesome.
Yeah, it taps into that really creepy Charles Darwin-esque, like, biology sort of vibe of, yeah, where they'd string stuff up. You're right, he just immediately, like, this chapter just plonks you in, and it's like, this guy is ginormous and really powerful and just terrifying and unstoppable, and off you go.
Yeah, it's great. I think the other fun thing is here that, you know, Avery did the exploration of the ornithologist item last chapter to try and break down what type of thing he could be. But Verona does the same thing here, trying to figure out like what he is, but going at it just kind of like comparing the way that the two go about it is very interesting. Avery's kind of meticulous, goes through all the things that it won't be, and then dives through it, kind of breaking down the reasons why it's this and not this. And Verona kind of like dismisses a few based on vibes and then goes through and is like, oh, it kind of feels like this and this lines up to it. And she very quickly is like picking up like, oh, this is kind of what he's like. It's just comparing their styles by the way they identify what things might be, I think was very interesting.
Yeah, I'd almost phrase it as like Avery felt like she was working through the entire list of stuff she'd memorized.
Yes.
A bit. Like,
yes.
There was this big list of all the different types of items and she was kind of going through it piece by piece, whereas Verona does that very like from first principles. Like, okay, you have visceral, immaterial, and greater power. I can narrow him down to one of those three and kind of go from there. Just that difference in how their brains work. Avery, yeah, has like learned a bunch of stuff, whereas Verona is very focused on that bottom-up approach, which will obviously serve her well later.
Yeah, great way to put it.
Yeah, the thing that really jumped out to me here was like this trichotomy of like material, immaterial, and greater power. Like Verona sort of establishes for us this idea of, you know, when you can kill material things with material wounds, you sort of kill immaterial things with more immaterial wounds. And with these sorts of divine greater powers, you just don't.
Because they don't really fight the ornithologist. What they do is distract or evade or kind of fit into their followers. Like, there's no real way that they can hurt the ornithologist.
Mm. And like, obviously, you know, I guess I was just talking about that whole idea of like, oh, you know, there's less direct stakes in this. Like, the thing, I guess to go back to what I was saying before, I think the reason I really liked this fight compared to like something that's more entwined with the story as a change was because there is that sense of, oh, this is a puzzle that we can just figure out and kind of win. And they don't end up doing that, but it's like, you know, in Arc 13, I'm not expecting just some aha moment from Verona to beat Marisica and Charles. Like, it was never going to be that easy, whereas this is a fight that might be. But it's obviously that whole vibe of this is like a divine or a greater power that is in its domain and we can't really injure it materially or immaterially. I was like, okay, so, you know, we're going to go fight Charles soon, right? Like, how, you know, we clearly don't fight him in the Carmine domain. That's pretty fucking established right here.
The only thing that they do that really seems to make any impact against the ornithologist is when Verona gets out of the painting to stab Thea, and that kind of shakes the area, right? Like, that's...
Yeah, they fuck with the domain itself.
Yeah, which kind of implies got to do some out-of-the-box thinking there if we're going to extract that to Charles, but, like, fuck with the domain? Yeah, gosh.
I mean, the family man is possibly even another one. We know he's getting a little bit divine, and he's not quite there yet, so he's going to be a bit more vulnerable, but he's another one where it's like, if we head into the Undercity surrounded by his cult, like, this is some of the shit we should expect. Like, it's you versus the world if you're in their domain. So the Kenneteers are like, all of their upcoming enemies are starting to be more and more in this greater power realm, and it's like, okay, like, you're gonna really need to try and figure out how you fight things like that. And the answer at the moment seems to be, first of all, you've got to somehow get them out of their home.
Verona quickly clambers up a chimney and stabs Thea, causing her to drop the painting, which, as we said, kind of buys them time. And I think this is hilarious. Like, imagine you're running around carrying a painting, you know, and yes, there's people in the painting, but you kind of are thinking, oh, they're distracted. And somebody just kind of jumps out and stabs you in the ankle and falls back in. Like, what the fuck? I love it.
Well, especially because you trapped them in there too. Yeah. Like, just the idea that you trap someone in a painting and then a knife comes out and stabs you in the leg. You're like, oh, fucking just be trapped, you idiots.
Yeah, that's good stuff.
I do like this moment. Like, again, it kind of catches Avery a bit off guard where she's like, you stabbed her?
I mean, she trapped you in a painting. She's trying to kill you, Avery. Jesus Christ.
But this is just more of those little moments of like Verona, because Verona's sort of like, well, it worked, and Avery's like, I guess. And you know, like, again, Verona just constantly sort of prodding Avery with like, hey, sometimes violence good.
yeah
Actually, on the sort of whole note of tracking how Verona is thinking about this stuff, because I think we talked last week about how, like, Verona is sort of saying, oh, I'm, you know, fine with killing Charles, blah, blah, blah. We were a little unsure of how okay she actually would be with that. Something that comes up here is, and in last chapter, is Avery had to tell Verona that the priority was the children they're trying to save. Like, by default, Verona's priority is making sure Avery can go back to having her good life in Thunder Bay. And Avery is kind of the one who essentially tells Verona, no, the priority is to save the kids. And if that screws up my Thunder Bay, that's still a win. And both in that chapter and in this chapter, Verona sort of explicitly notes that that means she has to, like, rearrange those things, which is, like, good that she can do that, but that also arguably very scary in that Alexandria way that she had to. That, like, saving these kids was not her default most important thing.
Yeah, it's, yeah, I guess kind of worrying, isn't it? I don't know. It's very Verona.
Yeah, exactly. Verona... but, you know, this is that thing where if Verona grows up around Lucy and Avery, she's a good person. If she doesn't, she's an Alexander.
Well, yeah, it's interesting. I guess, again, jumping ahead, but Verona, throughout this chapter, is very clearly, and this is something that obviously we've seen a fair amount of from her, her motivation for doing what she's doing is Avery and Lucy, right? She, the thing that she really seems to care about is fighting for Avery and Lucy specifically, not really any of the other stuff that they're doing. I mean, she likes the escapism of it, but I really get the sense that, and we'll see this very explicitly in a bit, I think she'd be willing to just give up on magic, on her life, potentially, if not for Avery and Lucy.
Yeah, let's get to that. I assume you're talking about the Margot part. Yeah,
we'll get to that in a bit, I suppose.
Yeah, let's save most of that for there. But yeah, no, I kind of agree. I just think there's an argument to be made that that's kind of a shitty thing. Yeah, like, that's if your priority healthy. Is
exactly.
Well, yeah, if your priority is Avery because she's your friend over random citizens to save, that's not like a classic hero choice. You know, Superman would choose the bus of civilians over Lois, or, you know, he'd find some way to cheat and do both. But
yeah, but it's over herself, right? Like, it's Avery.
Oh yeah, that well that too.
Willing to,
yeah,
and I guess that's a classical kind of heroic vibe. But you really feel the toxicity in it with Verona here, right? Like, she's so putting herself last.
Well, yeah, and you know, if there's anything her best friend loves, it's people who go around sacrificing themselves. So, and this has already been a point of contention between those two for a while, and it's not seemingly going to go away anytime soon.
No.
Before we move on from this section, I just wanted to call out this hilarious little bit where Verona's still wearing a silence rune, and so she shouts something at Avery, and the text is just like a bunch of empty spaces with an exclamation mark after it. Like, it's one of those little moments of Wildbo using the medium in a really fun way where, like, we don't get to see what she shouted because she had the silence rune on. Just funny.
Yes, it's great. I really like this too. Just a great little, you know, Wildbo having fun with the text kind of moment.
Yeah, exactly. Just a little moment of, that's clever.
Verona has thoroughly pissed off the ornithologist now, so she attempts to stay out of his reach while kind of distracting him to give Avery more time.
Yeah, and they're fucking scrambling at this point because she's like, he comes sort of back from falling over, and he's just much more like, I'm going to fuck you two specifically up than he was before, where he was just kind of chilling and making his way over. There's honestly an argument to be made that Verona made things worse.
Yeah.
By overdoing it.
I mean,
things weren't going well before. I'm not saying they would have been fine if she hadn't done this, but maybe there was a different way to go about it.
Yeah, maybe. I really love, again, we've kind of touched on this, but him in his domain, he's just so impossible to fight. I just love it. It's just so delightful.
Like, yeah, like,
Verona will go and try and hide behind a chimney, and he'll just be like, nope. Take away that chimney.
I've seen people in the chat mention it, and we had it here in the notes as well. This is what you imagine fighting some, like, a human in their, like, domain would be. Like, I guess, you know, while we're talking about fighting gods on their turf or something, the other thing that's sitting in the back of my head is, like, Verona is the one who skirted around the idea of getting a domain. And now she's here, like, fighting someone who is, like, a god on their turf. And I wonder if that's going to, like, sit in the back of her head as, like, oh, can I have a space where I'm basically god? That would be nice.
I mean, we already know she's keen on domains for reasons like that, having her own space that is so undeniably her own.
Yeah, exactly. Like, I'd love to sort of see... yeah, I don't know. I guess it's not really a priority right now, but as we do sort of start to tie into all these other things, like what they can do with the power source at the end of this chapter, like, you know, is that something that she can consider now? Probably just not in Kennet right now. I think that was the decision last time that came up last week.
Yeah. Verona continues to run around and tackle the Ornithologist subjects, getting into a few scrapes as she kind of works her way back up towards Avery.
Yeah, again, fucking classic. I love this just pure chaos fight scene of her running around an environment we don't really understand, tackling a bunch of weird people coming at her as she's trying to puzzle together how to win fight. Like, just classic stuff.
Yeah, there's some horrifying moments in here. Like, there's this bit where she tears a mask away from a woman's face and expects it to just be like, oh, you know, it's a mask. But it, like, pulls off, it's part of her face, so it, like, pulls off the flesh of the face, and it's just, like, fucking horrifying. And Verona's just kind of, like, even really thinking about it, just kind of like, yep, cool, oh, now I can use this to blah, 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 and just running with it while I'm kind of stopped being like, Verona, you just pulled off a woman's face.
Yeah, isn't the woman, like, buckled over in pain and shit?
Yeah, like, screaming.
Yeah, which gives Verona the chance to escape, so, you know. Worked
out. Yeah. I also, we haven't touched on this, but, like, the color palette of the Ornithologist world is, like, this brownie thing. And it's, like, it's so fun because it's evocative of those, like, you know, old biology drawings, which is obviously the vibe of the Ornithologist. And it's, yeah, just such a fun, like, this realm being so consistent with the vibe of an old biology dude. It's just so great.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. Like, it's such a... I can't think of anything I've ever seen that's, like, that. Or that's used it in this sort of way. Like, I've never seen anything animated that lent into this sort of imagery. It's just so cool. I do admit, I was glad the text was constantly reminding me that everything was coffee stain brown, because I did keep forgetting. And, like, the fact that they all looked a bit sketched and stuff. Like,
yeah.
So I had written here in the notes, like, yesterday, I hope at one point Wildbo just has an extra material that's just, like, a picture of the paintings that Thea had, so I could make sure I fully understood, like, what it was meant to look like. But then, obviously, this morning on the subreddit, Fonica posted, like, this great fan art of the Ornithologist, which was pretty much what I was picturing. So I was like, okay, good. And I was really glad to have that.
Loved it.
But how cool would, like, a Thea's Vault EM have sort of been? Like, we could have seen the pictures, seen, like, the wards,
just a fun, like, again, you know, it's fun to have a big, scary other that is just kind of doing some rad shit, and we get to fight them.
The other moment here in amongst all of these fights that's really worth pulling out is Verona gets the temporary tattoo again from Clem and sticks that on. But there's so much attention on her, it's draining it too quickly. So she starts to power it with herself. And so what she is doing here is draining herself to try and fit in with the society of this world of the Ornithologist, which is obviously tapping into all that stuff we were talking about before. If that's what it feels like Verona is doing all the time in the real world, and that's what she's stopped. I just love this little metaphor of her powering the temporary tattoo with herself is her literally draining herself to fit in. she's done that here, and, you know, is she going to keep doing that, or has she learned her lesson? Because it feels like in general that's behavior she's moving away from right now.
It's a good symbolism. So yeah, Verona reunites with Avery, but unfortunately the Ornithologist has already ruined her diagram, so Verona hurries over to inspect it. I want to pull out this moment as well, because again, what we're talking about here, like how much Verona is willing to go all out at the expense of herself, the capital S, I guess. There's this moment where she thinks about how she should have used the alchemy and transformed. Screw everything else, what am I holding on to? dinner with everything else on the line, blah, blah, blah. Like, I don't know. Like, she's clearly not learned the lesson of her hand, which is sometimes going all out only hurts you and doesn't make a difference. Although she doesn't use the alchemy, so maybe she has learned the lesson. I don't know.
I mean, well, this is that, and like, this is something she explicitly thought about in that fight with Cleo in the store in Arc 13. Like, she, like, when she holds back, it sort of costs her, and then now she's starting to learn that when she goes all out, it costs her. I think she's just starting to realize that this stuff has a cost associated with it. But like, the alchemy line in particular, I think really makes sense, because the whole thing she ends up doing here is because of the temporary tattoo, she drains herself and gets kind of weak and exhausted anyway. So, like, there is a little bit of, like, she is kind of suffering on the front. The alchemy costs her anyway. So she may as well have done it, because she's paying the same price in the end. Like, what she did with the temporary tattoo and feeding it with herself kind of was just as bad. I don't know. It's tricky. I do really resonate with that idea of, like, you know, by not using the alchemy, she's getting to the end and she feels like that person who, you know, still has all the grenades and stuff she picked up throughout the whole campaign, but she didn't want to use them because she was saving them. And then you get to the end of the final boss and you're like, why didn't I use this shit?
Yeah, a hoarder is what we call them. Yeah. But yeah, so Verena heads over to the diagram and very quickly guesses what it was meant to be, using it to create some escape ropes.
Jesus, like, what a, holy shit.
Yeah, like, this is one of those moments to keep in mind for when Verona is moping about how she's falling behind in the practice, so that we can pull this out and be like, Verona, what the fuck are you talking about?
Yeah, and she's a bit like, oh, Avery, it was harder than you made out, because there's no instructions. And it's just like, wait, you figured it out without the instructions?
Yep.
Yeah, like, again, this is just that ground-up understanding of things that she's just so good at, like, and we're seeing it again. Like, she sort of is like, oh, okay, you know, like, that's heraldic, and so that implies this about it, and the blah, blah, blah. Whereas, like, you can kind of tell Avery probably understands some of that, but largely is just kind of memorized the general structure of it.
Yeah.
And I really like, Verona kind of shows off that from the bottom-up level knowledge. So she takes note of the fact that the number 12 is super important to the diagram, but doesn't really figure out why. She just kind of jots that down as important. And I went and Googled it to check, and yeah, like, the 12th tarot card is the Hanged Man. And yeah, this thing's obviously the Hanged Man's rope. So Verona doesn't, like, seem to consciously tie that detail together, but she, like, she just has that ability to notice 12 is important, and she kind of works from there to notice other details. Like, it's just...
yeah.
Really cool how this system and her are able to be built up in that logical way that you can track and that makes sense.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And it's great that, yeah, she just kind of gets it without even kind of figuring out the exact reasons why some of the things are there. Like, she doesn't have the theoretical knowledge. She's just practically very quick at figuring these things out.
Yeah, which is, yeah. Like, you know, what I aspire to be. I don't think I'm anywhere near Verona's level, but, like, as somebody who's fucking dog shit at rote learning, like, it's the way I prefer to operate. And it's really cool to see somebody just be really good at it.
Yeah. So, yeah, they emerge from the painting and they find themselves in Thea's vault with all kinds of anti-magic and anti-noise protections.
How did Snowdrop get in here? Like, they pop out of the painting and Snowdrop's just there. And I mean, we kind of get it because we know her and Avery connected, but I'm kind of in awe at this whole story to this that we missed of Snowdrop breaking into this vault.
Yeah, maybe that'll be a interlude. We'll get a Snowdrop interlude where she's sneaking after Thea and has to quickly run into the vault while Thea's back is turned.
Mission impossible. It's right there.
Oh, that's good. That's very good. I love this moment where Verona looks around and sees, oh, okay, this pillar has an octopus skull on it. The bones of the tentacles draping down. Octopi didn't have bones, which is just a great penny drop moment that I thought was wonderful.
Oh, because it worked on me. I totally forgot that. Like, I was just like, oh, yeah, octopus skeleton makes sense. And I was like, octopus don't have bones. And I was like, oh, yeah, I forgot that.
Yeah. I really like the kind of ambient storytelling of Thea having all of these items that are all just alternate worlds. And it's like... It's clear, this clear desperation of her trying to, you know, just like find all these alternate world things so that she can either try them out, maybe, and see if they're an alternate world that she wants to live in, or just harvest them for this, what she's now doing, which is building her own alternate world. And it's just like, there's such a desperation to it. It's really sad.
Yeah, like she's built all of this stuff, and it's just seemingly to create something that's similar to where she was, you know, founded, I guess, as a person, like where she got stuck in this original board game. Yeah, like you're right. It's just kind of, you just like, oh, like it, because it's so cool though. Because on the one hand, you end up in this vault, and instead of it just being this, you know, random collection of artifacts, you quickly realize this vault is also like a diagram that's playing out to build something, and all these things are feeding power into it. And then, like, on the one hand, that's really cool because it turns this vault into like a puzzle that can be solved and understood. But the end game is just that board game that's just a little bit like, oh, that sucks.
Yep. Pretty tragic.
One little detail I just wanted to call out because of how deep a cut it is. They note that on one of the pillars, there's like a unicorn, and that's the one that's not active because presumably Thea was going to chuck the boy who escaped into it later. And I think it's Avery who just sort of briefly says, oh, yeah, I think that unicorn was one of Clem's. And I was like, oh, like, what are you talking about? And I was trying to figure out if this was that, I can't remember the name of it, but that thing that Clem had that like joins sets but doesn't fit in, like the odd one out or whatever. Like, I couldn't figure out what this meant. So I went back, and in the 4.8 dossiers, there's like one sentence dedicated to Clem finding a like broken unicorn toy that took her to like a dream realm, and she ended up not going there. And that's like it. I was like, holy shit, how did Wilbur / Avery remember that? That is,
yeah, I know, right? That's some good,
so long ago
right there.
Well, yeah, it took me looking it up to even come close to remembering it.
I mean, Wilbur must have a spreadsheet of like, here's all the magical items that I've mentioned, so that I can see if I can pull any of them in again later.
I mean, wait, because it's a great little detail. I love that like connection to like, oh, this is one of those little things we've seen, but it's like, it's such a crazy one that Wilbur had to call it out to us. And also, I'm sitting here going, how does Avery remember that?
Yeah, I can't. Wilbur is confirming he doesn't have a spreadsheet that tracks all those, which makes it even more impressive in my mind.
Because that means it's all in your head.
I can pull back in this unicorn from ages ago. Anyway.
Yeah, it's more impressive that it's just up in Wilbur's head.
Yeah. I just opened up 4.8, the 4.8 dossier, and it's like, it's one or two sentences. A chipped unicorn figurine prompted dreams of increasing realism and depth each time she slept with it nearby. You know, oh, it's a few more sentences than that, but it's like a paragraph. It's not.
It's just sandwiched into, you know, the giant list of shit that Clem does.
Yes, and this is in the part of Clem's life where we're going through the timeline of all the things that she's, all the problems that she's run into. So there's a lot of, you know, magical items around it to make it, you know, fit in.
Yeah. I'm just as impressed Avery remembered it as, yeah, Wilbur, I guess. I know Wilbur made all this up, but still, that was over a year ago.
Yeah, yeah. Verona goes on a bit of a journey through Thea's Vault of Horrors, rescuing children as she goes. And in this sinister hospital, she finally gets a bit of an opportunity to take a breather. I always call it the horny hospital, but I thought that was maybe a bit much.
Yeah, although, like, I mean, you know, this isn't even the most sinister hospital that Verona has been to this arc.
True.
So
she does sinister hospitals a lot.
So the sinister hospital also doesn't quite work. I don't know what just the place in the horn or something.
At least Verona has gone to a hospital that fixes her hand.
Yeah, exactly. I just, like, this place is just so fucked up, though. Like, I love the vibe of this place that's trying to convince you that the other reality that you go back to is fake. Like, it clearly wants to set up that dynamic from, for some reason, the example that jumps to my mind is there's that Doctor Who episode where they can't tell which version of reality is the dream and which one isn't. And this one's trying to do that same shtick on you of, like, the real world will convince you this one's fake. This one's trying to convince you that the real world's fake. And they're trying to lure you into the paradise one.
Yeah.
Like, it's just so, it's such a fuck. Like,
yeah, it's good, isn't it? And I love that, the thing that I think has Verona not fall into this too much is it feels too good to have parents that are attentive and like caring. Well, like, wait, that's the thing that feels so insidious to her is having parents that care about her. So there's no way that she's going to fall for it.
But I mean, like, that's all, on the same hand, like, that's kind of the trap, right? Is like this place, you know, it gives her a mother and father who care about her and will dote on her.
Yes.
Like this place is designed to kind of draw in the people who, I mean, and we see it with Margot in a second. Margot almost doesn't give a shit that she knows this one's fake. It's nicer and it's better and she wants to believe in it. And she even gets to the point where it's like, they might kill you in 5 years here. And she's like, I don't care.
Yeah, worth it. Like, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, let's talk about that, right? Because...
Before we go, like, I just love, like, this is the sort of moment where you're like, oh, of course it had to be Verona who went into these and we saw this from her and not Avery because... you know, Verona is the one who we've accused of doing escapism into the Undercity. So, of course, Verona has to be here having this conversation with Margot because she's usually the one on the other side of this.
Yeah. The interaction with Margot is wild because Verona doesn't have many arguments, right? Like, Verona's argument... Margot wants to stay here and Verona is kind of like, yeah, I get it. And doesn't really have much to dissuade her. The argument she says is, you know, your friends out there and other people that you don't know will get hurt by Thea getting power from you and kind of feeding off of you, right? And therefore you have, it's like this duty or responsibility that she puts forward to Manga, which works. But it's like, I don't know, like very revealing about her current psychological state that she is willing... She has no arguments for why somebody should choose to live effectively other than the duty that they have to their friends.
Yeah. I mean, like, usually Verona is the Margot in this conversation where somebody's like, hey, come back to reality. And she's like, fucking, what for? And so, yeah, like, Verona doesn't really have anything except, hey, it helps the bad people if you stay here and, you know, what if your friends need you? And that, because like, that's the only thing that stopped her going fucking off, you know, probably with Mariska. Like, you know, if Verona hadn't had those morals, Mariska might have been able to take off with her fucking arc too.
I mean, Verona might also just have chosen to stay at the Sinister Hospital, right?
Like, yeah.
You know, if not for the arguments she puts forward.
Yeah. And that's what's so great about like that moment where you're like, oh, this is why Wabo chose to have Verona be the one who goes into this painting, because this is just Verona has come here to pull someone out, while at the same time this place is just directly targeting her. Like, she is exactly the sort of person who, if she had not awoken, could have ended up in this sort of painting and just gotten lost to it and not have cared, like Margot. Like, the good thing that sort of comes out of this though is, as Verona talks both of them out of staying, she does kind of help promise to try and get, like, you know, Zed and Ray to make this online bullying that Margot's suffering go away. And that, like, that's just such a good, like, this is that moment where you're like, Verona, don't you see that, like, this is what people have been trying to do with you and your dad? Like I understand that everything you're going through is tough, but like, if you let these people pull you out, they can try and help you with that shit. A horn, not a painting.
Are you picturing Thea's vault as a, you know, Super Mario 64?
I'm trying not to, but like, because the first one was a painting. I keep just picturing them all as paintings in my head, even though we were explicitly told they're not. you also mentioned earlier, and it's worth pointing out, Verona does take a few hours in here because it's only a couple of minutes outside. And I just love that, because the thing that we really saw last week and has long been a thing for her is Verona doesn't get that time to just process. And so she takes advantage of it here. And I love that she manages to turn this horrible stuff and this world that is tempting her and kind of get the good out of it. Like, she does get a few hours to just sit there and just zone out, like, which is what she needs. And she manages to even spend the last couple of those hours being productive and like figuring out the vault. But in general, it's just like, yeah, she turns this world that's trying to trap her and uses the good part of the trap without falling for it.
I think they later, when they loot the prison, they take the vault, they take some stuff, They don't take the horn. I feel like Verona could use this horn. I mean, I'm sure there's a downside if she just keeps going in there to get some thinking time, but
yeah.
God, it would be nice.
Well, yeah, because didn't, like, they had, this is a weird plug. I remember how they had one of these in, like, Dragon Ball Z when I was a kid. There was, like, a room that they could go in and they could do, like, a week's worth of training in a minute or something.
Right.
And Goku used it to get stupid strong or something.
Mm.
So, yeah, like, just... You try to use the time dilation. I mean, this is the other verse. If you try to abuse a system like this, you're right. There'll be some consequence, but
yeah,
seems fucking handy.
Yeah, take that horn. Why not? Anyway, so yeah, they have freed all the kids from their prisons. So Verona kind of comes out and kind of pretty quickly and effectively dismantles it, freeing them to loot the prison a bit and escape.
Yep, and we get Thea's battery, which I can't wait to see. Which of the many, many important causes we dedicate that to.
yeah.
This feels like we were just talking last week. I think it was Avery and Verona had that conversation about how, oh, it'll be hard to anchor extra shrines because we don't have the power. Now maybe we do. Like, can they enact one of their shrine border plans to save Kennet? I'm worried that they're going to have to spend it all killing the family man.
Mm.
But we'll see.
Yeah, we'll have to see. It was great. Verona pulls out the knife, which still had some Thea blood on it, to you know, disguise, yeah. I guess, what they're doing with Thea's essence. And I just think that's so great. Like, obviously it wasn't really planned out, but it just kind of works so neatly and is wonderful.
Yeah, it's almost just a happy accident. Or like just, yeah, you know, the way that Verona's always thinking about this stuff leads to you being able to finish that story for yourself. Like,
yeah.
She holds on to this sort of stuff, and then it's like, oh yeah, and now I've got this knife covered in Thea's blood, which might help this not set off the wards so much.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That said, though, I need to call out these dropped knives. I can't believe they've ended up being useful.
They're so useful.
They're so this one's, stupid.
Yeah, I don't know. This one's basically just used as a knife. But yeah, so they escape. They sneak past Thea as she's angrily on the phone with you, Legendre, which is very fun.
Yeah, I love how she's mistaken them for witch hunters, because that's, like, this is Verona's reward, because something we didn't talk about when she was in the fight, she was very awkwardly making sure she did things so that they weren't obviously practitioners.
Yes.
Because she was still trying to prioritize Avery's ability to have her Thunder Bay life. And, like, yeah, so even though that sort of cost them and made things really difficult, it's really worked out, because that's convinced Thea that they're witch hunters, which is a very sensible, like, she even specifically calls them out as being Montreal witch hunters, which, based on what we've seen, I'm like, oh yeah, that actually really tracks. And so now it's sowing some discord in Musa's camp. Like, this is really working.
Didn't expect it, but it has worked pretty well.
And sorry, it's worth pointing out Thea is aware of the Montreal witch hunters in part because they're allies, which, like, I can't decide whether I think that reflects worse on Musa or the Montreal witch hunters.
They deserve each other.
Like, just because what we saw from Cleo, just the idea that the Montreal witch hunters ally with big practitioner groups is just very much like, you fucking hypocrites. Like,
oh yeah, 100%.
Like, I get that it's probably necessary for your survival. Like, I think if they went to war with every and all practitioner, they'd very quickly die. So I get that it's the only reason they're around, but also, isn't, like, your whole fucking thing that you're not practitioners?
Yeah. It's, I don't know. Like, it's interesting. It's interesting. We talked about this a lot when we were talking about the witch hunters when they were in Kennet, but, I'm still not sure what to expect of Otis, because there's no hard confirmation here that Otis is, like, approving of what Thea's doing here. We get Thea talking about using some of Otis's tricks to lure in this escaped child. So the fact that Otis has tricks designed to lure in escaped children is maybe a bad sign.
Yeah, it's not looking good for Otis on the moral front after this. I mean, maybe she uses these without really telling him why, which isn't great either, but that's better than him knowing.
Yeah, but the fact that he has tricks that are good for luring in children is kind of...
Well, yeah. I mean, but he's a black forest, like, you know, he's a Hansel and Gretel catching witch. I mean, it's just, you know,
it's just part of the.
Of course, he has that. Yeah. I mean, the other thing here, so we obviously get confirmation that Thea has at least received an offer from Musa. I'm curious what people, like, this is a question to the chat as well as you, Ruben. What does Musa want from Thea, do you reckon? Like, obviously, we know she has this specialization in capturing mini realms or something.
Yeah.
How would something like that help his dictatorship? Or the other thing we've seen is she's seemingly really good at these wards. Like, you know, we saw the ward only let certain kids at the painting. Obviously, her vault is very well warded. I don't know if she's good enough at this, that it's a subspeciality or whatever, but like, even that, like, alongside the realms thing, I'm like, how does that help Musa? Like, what does she have that has made her someone that Musa reached out to?
We talked about the concept of, you know, Charles having the domain that he is strongest in and has control over. So maybe that's part of what it is a tool to use against Charles with his domain.
So she's for the end game when they actually go after Charles.
Yeah, or just like, you know, Charles is already fighting them. So the we're already in a bit of the needing to protect ourselves from Charles vibe.
Yeah, but how does she help with that? Like, yeah, if you're in one of her realms, you can't really claim a lordship, I assume.
No, but, you know, presumably she knows enough about magical realms just from her experience that she might have some ways to prevent Charles from exerting influence or, I don't know, whatever.
Yeah, yeah, maybe. Yeah, that makes sense. I think the other thing she says here is when she gets political, she heads roll. That's her version of getting political. And I have decided that, yes, let's make Thea get political. That sounds like a great fun from a story perspective.
Yeah, chop off some Musa heads. So yeah, they've escaped. Verona parts from Avery, apologizing for making things more complicated, and heads back to Kennet.
Yeah, and Avery does her darndest here to, like, try and have a D&M. Verona kind of rejects it, saying, yeah, we probably do need one, but, you know, I'll be fine. Classic Verona, I guess. I don't know. This is just something we've said, like, 100 times, but, you know, Verona had a chance to lean on her friend here a bit, and she didn't really take it. It's not anything new.
Verona. We get some interactions with her and her mum, which is fun.
Yeah, I love that. Something that we really saw in Verona's head, I think it was last week, was how much she was scared that she was really upsetting her mum by, like, not hanging out with her like this. And so even though she's not quite ready to open up to Avery, she does very just straight up open up to her mum and is like, are you mad that I kept delaying and cancelling? And Verona's mum's just like, should I be? And when Verona says no, her mom's just like, then I'm not. Come on, let's go. And I was like, I love for Verona that she's now seeking that confirmation and is able to close off that worry she has about her mom being angry at her. But also just her mom's response there is the most Verona shit I've ever heard. Of like, are you mad? Should I be? No. Then whatever. Like, I'm just remembering early in the story when, like, Lucy and her would have a fight and you know, Verona would be like, I don't want to be mad at you anymore, and you've said sorry, so now I'm not mad. And like, that would just break off. Yeah, and like, that would break Lucy's brain. And it's like, you can see where she got it from right here, because her mom just pulls the same shit.
Yeah, it's good stuff. I think it was interesting, her mom raises the idea of moving to Thunder Bay, right?
Yeah.
And Verona seems to have a very strong, visceral kind of gut reaction of no, can't do that.
Yeah, and it's still, like, you know, this is what we've been talking about since Arc 10, right? There's part of you that's just like, shouldn't you, though? Like, I mean, yeah, she's got stuff going on in Kennet, but there's certainly a lot of her problems that get fixed by her moving in with her mum, and fuck, it's good to see her mum offering that for once. I don't know. It feels like, surely by the end of the story, that's a decision Verona will have to make. I don't know. But I feel like I would have said that about now, 4 arcs ago. Like, I would have said, surely by arc 15, she'd have to be seriously considering it. So we'll see.
Yeah. It feels like she has to, right? It feels so inevitable, I suppose.
It fixes so many problems. I mean, yes, it leaves other problems.
Lucy alone is the main problem.
I mean, I guess this is that thing, right? It would be good for Verona, but it would probably be bad for Kennet. And that's why she can't do it.
Yeah, that's the trade that she's unwilling to make.
And she does say something to her mum, which is important. Something every time Avery expresses anything like, oh, you know, I'm sorry to have left you guys, Verona is immediately like, don't be an idiot, we need you here. This is good. This is good for you. It's good for us, blah, blah. The second she hops in the car with her mum and Avery's out of view, she's like, fuck, it's so hard without Avery. We really need Avery. It's just like, I'm glad that she's at least comfortable enough with her mum that she can say stuff like that, because she's clearly unwilling to say it to Avery, which is probably the right thing to do.
Probably, but still. And we leave on this ominous line. I hope Lucy's managing okay, which we know she's not. We know that by the time Brenna gets back, it's going to shit. It will have hit the fan very much. But yeah, just a fun fun way to lead us back into the mindset of things going screwy in Kennet.
I loved this because my first thought when I pulled up 15.8 and saw if it was Verona, I was like, oh, fuck yes. Like, we've just left Lucy away for a week. Like, that's going to be fun. And this is sort of, as much as it was great that this week we really got to see Avery and Verona and explore and compare and contrast those two, the chapter leaves you on that vibe of, hey, but remember the last time we saw Lucy and the shit was starting to hit the fan? We're about to go back to that mess. And because that was what the start of this arc was, is it kind of, it was setting up the family man and the fact that Verona was leaving, and you're like, oh, okay, I see where this is going. Like, the family man's going to explode around the end of the arc, probably, and that looks like it's going to be what's happening at this stage.
Classic. So, I guess we will have to get into that when we have our next chapter, which will presumably be a Lucy chapter.
Oh, you'd think, right? Like, I guess it could be Verona again, as she has to sit for 24 hours and just watch it all go to hell remotely.
Yeah, sounds fun.
I'm so excited. Like, something I was thinking about, I think we talked about this a bit last week, but like, the, you know, that mapping of the four leaders of the Undercity and how they map to like the Ken components, and talking about like, if Liz is explicitly building up these leaders like the family man, is Liz going to take it personally if they try to take down the family man? Like, if that is explicitly something she's trying to cultivate in building her new self by building the Undercity a specific way. I don't know. I'm just desperate to see Liz. We've been talking about this since fucking 14.2, it feels like, where it was like, oh, Liz is doing some crazy shit and shaping the town. And it's like, can we go fucking talk to this woman and find out what she's trying to do? Because just... the fact that she's building the family man feels like she wants devout cult followers to be a thing, or she wants to be worshipped. Like, that needs to be addressed. Like, I really hope that this whole thing with the family man is really just an excuse to finally have a fucking conversation with Liz.
Yeah. I think it'll be really interesting seeing what the relationship between Liz and the Undercity is, because I don't think we know how Liz is playing into that or what that looks like.
Yeah. Like, since like a few weeks ago, we had that moment of, oh, these four leaders mapped to the Ken components. I've been assuming that Liz is sort of feeding and directing the Undercity to a large extent. And that could be wrong, but it just, I don't know. It feels right to me that she's explicitly helping it lean in certain directions and explicitly trying to help these four be the leaders to sort of feed into her. And I just, we need to have a conversation to figure out if that's right, because it feels right to me, and that's cause, just somebody talk to Liz, for fuck's sake.
Maybe there's an under Liz. Maybe there's a like mirror Liz that is the Undercity version.
Yeah. I mean, exactly. And maybe she's trying to feed. I don't know. Like, that's the thing. We need to better understand her exact relationship with what's going on both above and below.
Yeah.
And what would fix that up real fucking quick, guys, is
is go and talk to her.
Lucy, Verona, go and have a chat with her.
But yeah, I mean, that's where we leave the these chapters.
Yeah. I can't wait. I can't wait to dive back into the mess that is Kennet.
Yeah, 100%.
Yeah, after this little hiatus of fun romp action scenes in Thunder Bay, now we're going to have to get back to the serious shit.
Back to the real problems. But before then, let's pull out some predictions, some pale predictions left in our pale predictor form by the community. Predictions left by people like you, who go to the pale predictor form that's linked in the show notes down below and leave their predictions. I've put out a prediction by Aster 2.0, and I really love
this. Is that really a mantle you want to take?
I really love this one. It's talking about the underside and how we know that the substitute teacher got into the underside just by, you know, having a few bad days or doing something kind of reckless. And they made the link that it would make sense that Verona's dad could slip into the Undercity through something similar. And then Verona would need to go and rescue him, presumably, which would be a real kind of wake-up call of what the Undercity is and the kind of people that are there. And I just think that will really interestingly impact her relationship with the Undercity if it happens. So I just think that's, I don't know, a very interesting idea. I would hate it, of course, but it would be very fun to explore.
Oh, Verona trying to save her dad would just be so painful to watch. I'd love it. I don't know. I could definitely see this. I mean, it does definitely feel like if you had to make a list of people in Kennet who you think would slip through, Verona's dad would probably be on it. Yeah.
I just thought that was wonderful. Did you have what prediction did you pull out, Elliot?
So I pulled out a prediction from Awesome Toast, who basically has this theory that Thea is currently maybe aligned with Musa, or Musa's made her an offer. But if you think about her whole shtick of running away from reality and kidnapping children, there's another team who she more closely aligns with, and that's the team that has Marissica and Charles on it. So just this idea that Thea doesn't actually care about practitioners. She's in this for herself, and what she's trying to do probably more closely aligns with Marissica and Charles than Musa. So maybe that's the team she could end up on later, is she might turn on Musa and actually go with Charles / Marissica. And I love that link, that like her whole MO kind of much more closely aligns with something Marissica and Charles could help her with than Musa.
Yeah, I especially love that, if that means we might see more of Thea around Kennet as like a not fully opposed to the Kenneteers force.
So somebody, somebody who's just visiting for business.
Yeah, how wild would that be? I think that would be very delightful.
It's also a great excuse to bring Marissica back, because obviously, you know, Charles is the center stage at the moment, but we're kind of just assuming that Marissica is in the wings, you know, pulling strings and helping. And Thea would probably get a lot more out of working directly with Marissica. And there's all the stuff, like Thea's history with fairy-ish creatures. Like, it feels like a great excuse to bring Marissica out of hiding again and put her in the spotlight again for a bit. So there's a lot to this prediction that I like.
Thanks Awesome Toast, and thanks Aster 2.0 for those predictions. Now normally we would have a discussion question here, but as I mentioned before, our schedule is going to be a bit screwy for the next 2 weeks, so we're not going to do discussion questions this fortnight. But what I will let people know is that, like, for the episodes that I'm going to be doing in the next 2 weeks, obviously we'll still be doing them live, and I'm going to be pulling some comments out before the show to talk about from the Pale Spoilers channel in the Discord. So if you have thoughts on the next 2 weeks of chapters, you can just put your thoughts in the Pale Spoilers channel, and you know, I'll be kind of talking about and responding to things like that, because I won't have Elliot around to bounce off of, so I've got to bounce off of something. And yeah, so feel free to, you know, chuck your comments in there, or, you know, join the live recording and participate in the show.
I'm very excited to check those episodes out. I can't wait to listen to them.
Yeah. But yeah, thanks for joining us, folks. If you have thoughts on these chapters, or want to talk about the show, you can go to our discussion threads, which are linked in the show notes down below, and leave your comments there, or in the Discord at doofmedia.com/discord.
You can also find us on Twitter at Pale Reflect Cast. As those of you who follow the Twitter will know, the live reads are obviously on an extended hiatus. As you know, I'm leaving. I don't have time to do this show. I obviously didn't have time to do the live reads either. So now I guess we just post shitty memes there.
Excuse you. You post shitty memes. I post great memes.
No, what you do is take the format of the meme I've already scheduled and posted early. It's still all my likes. I'm on to exactly you, Ruben.
Right. Yeah, so you can go to Pale Reflect Cast for that if you're interested in that. Or go to doofmedia.com to check out more info about all the shows on the Doof Media Network. We should talk about this holiday live event thing that we're doing.
Yeah, I don't think we've nailed down exactly what time it will be. But for our other show, The High Ground, we're obviously doing our annual community watch of the Star Wars holiday special, everyone's favorite Star Wars content. So that'll be happening on the Discord. So if you're interested in coming along and watching that with us, Georgia, and everyone else in the Discord, join it using the link below, and then we'll get you the details when you can come and watch this shit show with us.
I think, are we also going to be live watching Shrek the Halls?
Shrek the Halls too. Shrek, yeah, but that's not the main attraction, is it? No. Like, Shrek is our current series, and that's why we will also be watching Shrek the Halls. But the main attraction, I think, is going to be the holiday special.
Yeah. Yeah, if you want to listen to The High Ground, it's a patron bonus show, so you get access to that by becoming a patron at patreon.com/diffmedia. It's a very fun show to record, and I really love it. So go and check it out if you haven't yet.
There is a publicly available version too, but that one's 6 months behind. So if you want to understand all the mad Shrek refs we're going to make when watching mm-hmm. Shrek the Halls, you'd need to be a patron to do that.
Yeah. And while you're on Patreon, why not check out Wildbo's Patreon as well? patreon.com/Wildbo. You can support him and help him build his own little world where he...
You already did it a bunch of times.
Pictures of birds. Yeah, true.
He made a bunch of worlds, and we need to keep giving him power so that he can keep, you know, killing kids in these wonderful worlds that he's made.
No, I think in this metaphor, Elliot, we're the kids that he's harvesting the power from, right?
Oh, no, you're right. Yeah. He feeds on, like, you know, the joy and the pain of that we experience reading his stories. Yeah, that makes sense.
So if you want to donate your wings and hamstrings of your souls, go to patreon.com/Wildbo. They have an option for that when you're becoming a patron. Yeah. You can enter a dollar amount, or you can enter, you know, wings and hamstrings of my soul.
They make it weirdly hard. It's, you know, one of those things where they clearly want the money, they don't want your soul. It's just annoying.
It's a great trade, though. I'll happily give up the wings of my soul for more other verse stories.
Yeah, I'm the same.
Anyway, bye everybody.